Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
If we measured success by longevity, then dinosaurs must rank as the number one success story in the history of land life. Not only did dinosaurs exercise an airtight monopoly as large land animals, they kept their commanding position for an extraordinary span of time, 130 million years. Our own human species is no more than 100,000 years old. True, the dinosaurs are extinct, but we ought to be careful in judging them inferior to our own kind. Who can say that the human system will last another 1,000 years, let alone 100 million? Now, that was the American paleontologist Robert T. Backer, a man of whom Tom Holland knows a great deal, because Tom, you are a massive dinosaur enthusiast, aren't you? You were interested in dinosaurs before you were interested in history, so dinosaurs is actually your real interest, is that right?
Yeah, dinosaurs is my number one passion, like lots of children. It was kind of my introduction to a world that was unlike the contemporary. So I would always kind of go up the lane behind a house and there'd be sheep or something, and I'd wish that there were tyrannosaurs or triceratops or whatever. And I think that the kind of glamour and the terror and the dread of the Mesozoic world is what kind of set me then up for the glamour and the dread and the terror of the Roman world. I kind of moved seamlessly along from, you know, Saurian apex predators to the Roman army as a kind of apex predator. And I must say that it's great on a history podcast. You know, we've been doing a lot of contemporary history recently, so it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
to be going back millions and millions of years. Although we should point out, we're not doing that, are we? This is not about dinosaurs.
Well, it's about dinosaurs in history, I suppose, isn't it?
Yes, it's about historical. We're not suddenly turning into a paleontology podcast. This is about the process by which people came to realize that dinosaurs had existed and the role that they've played in the imagination since their discovery, which I think is a completely fascinating topic.
It's a brilliant topic. So let's, we had quite a few questions to kick off with. So a good one from Drop Dead Gormless, Steve. He says, what's the earliest written record of the discovery of a fossil? Perhaps we can widen that out a tiny bit. What is the earliest point that we know that people are even aware of dinosaurs?
It's a great question. And there's a wonderful book written by Adrienne Meyer, who's she's in the intersection point between classicist and paleontologist. And she's looked at the records from ancient Greece, from Rome, and more recently, the legends that Native Americans have told about thunder beasts and kind of creatures like that. And her argument is that, say, in North America, the stories that are told about thunderbirds correspond to the discovery, perhaps, of pterosaurs in the kind of incredibly fossil-rich boneyards of the Wild West. I think that, in a way, the best problem is that lots of the bones that the Greeks and the Romans talk about are not dinosaurs, because the Mediterranean does not play host to a dinosaur-bearing fossil beds. But I think my favourite thesis that she has actually does relate to dinosaurs, and it also relates to Herodotus, who is my great hero as a historian, who I've translated. So I was particularly thrilled by Adrian's thesis on this, which is that Herodotus reports that in a kind of distant land, there's mountains and deserts, and there are creatures called griffins that lay on eggs. And Adrienne Meyer's argument is that this is literally a Chinese whisper, because this is, she says, perhaps a kind of garbled traveler's report from the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, just north of China, of the discovery of a what in effect is a dinosaur called Protoceratops, which is a beaked dinosaur. So you think of Triceratops, this is a Triceratops without any horns. And its eggs are kind of scattered all around, just waiting to be found. These were the first ever fossilized dinosaur eggs that anyone discovered in the 1920s. And so she says perhaps this legend of the griffin is a kind of report about the fossils of the skulls of Protoceratops weathering out of rock or whatever. It's a wonderful, I mean, it's kind of unprovable, but it is a kind of great idea.
Now, that then raises a big question, though, an obvious question, which I'm sure listeners will have thought of. What about dragons? I mean, dragons are a brilliant subject in and of themselves, but is there quite a few listeners asked about this on Twitter? Are dragons basically some sort of weird memory of dinosaurs? Not called John. And many others, say our notes, asked about dinosaurs and dragons. What do you think?
I don't want to go too deeply into dragons because I think we're going to do an episode specifically on them. But there is, so for instance, there is a report of a Roman who travels to what's now the Lebanon. And this is where Perseus, with the Gorgon's head, is supposed to have turned the sea monster that was about to devour Andromeda into stone. And he brings back what is thought and claimed to be this petrified monster that's risen up from the sea. And that is pretty clearly assumed that is some fossilized beast that's being brought back and it's being associated with dragons or sea monsters or whatever. I mean, I guess so, perhaps. I mean, you know, there are, I think it's telling that the dragon is particularly associated with China and China has incredibly rich fossil bearing rocks. So yes, probably. Actually, interestingly, the first known attempt to model something based on a fossil that we know is a statue of a dragon. It's in an Austrian town called Klagenfurt. Brilliant name. And there was supposedly a dragon there that was kind of preying on virgins and eating cattle and doing all the kind of stuff that a dragon does. And a brave knight comes along and kills it. And the dragon to this day is on the coat of arms of Klagenfurt. And I think in the 16th century, I think it was, they commissioned a statue of it. They had found what they thought was the skull of the dragon in the cave. And so the head of the dragon on this sculpture in Klagenfurt corresponds to the contours of this skull that was found. The only problem is that it's not a dinosaur skull. It's actually a skull of a woolly rhinoceros.
Oh.
And that was only discovered later.
So that reminds me of a story that I read in a brilliant essay written by a leading historian in The Guardian, I think it was, of all newspapers, about five or six years ago. The historian was you, and you were talking about Tiberius.
Oh.
Well, don't pretend to be surprised, because you emailed it to me yesterday. This, by the way, is how Tom Holland behaves. When he goes on holiday to Greece, where he now is, he spends his time emailing me his own old essays. So Tiberius.
That's normal
behavior. Tiberius came across a tooth, or was sent a tooth after an earthquake. Is that right? Something like this?
That's right. In what's now Turkey. And it's you can tell it. You've read my essay.
I'm not going to read your essay for you. That would be absolutely shaming. So there's an earthquake. Pliny the Elder says it's the worst earthquake in human memory. And Tiberius has a tooth, and he gets a mathematician. Is that right? To build a statue based on the tooth.
Kind of work. Yeah. And it's absolutely huge. And the tooth is probably a mastodon.
How do you know? How does anyone know?
Prehistoric elephant. Because there were a lot of elephants, prehistoric elephants there. And actually, an interesting example of... So they assumed that this tooth was human. I mean, it couldn't have been human, because obviously they weren't giant humans.
Right.
But on the neighbouring island of Samos, just across from the Aegean coast, the Asian Aegean coast, so one of the Greek islands, they found all kinds of bones, and they worked out that these were elephant bones. And so they said that these were elephants that had been brought by Dionysus when he came with a giant army from India to conquer Greece. So as far as I know, that is the earliest correct identification of a prehistoric fossil and its identification with the kind of animal that it really was.
Yeah.
So obviously the woolly rhinoceros skull at Klagenfurt, they got it completely wrong because it wasn't a dragon.
Yeah. But in Samos, they got it right.
This kind of ancient Greek story about elephants coming from India. Yeah, they did get it right. They did get it right.
And then obviously a moment that will excite you, the coming of Christianity. There are no dinosaurs in the Bible. There are no dinosaurs in the kind of mid.
There's a beast called Behemoth.
Right. Which is
it sounds a bit like a kind of a brachiosaur or something. It's a colossal land animal that makes the earth shake. And there's a marine one called Leviathan.
But there's no Mesozoic era in the Book of Genesis, though, is there? I mean,
no, there isn't.
And obviously, then in the Christian kind of sense of time, you know, all these people, bishops and saints, kind of people trying to work out when God created the earth and all when Abraham lived and all that stuff, they have no sense of dinosaurs then. So for generations, people live in complete and utter ignorance of a prehistoric dinosaur era. Am I right?
They assume that creation happened. Well, I mean, the notorious example of that is in the 17th century, 1650, James Usher, who is the Archbishop of Armagh.
Yes.
He tries to work out when the creation happened, and he goes through all the ancient texts, the classical texts and so on. But of course, ultimately, his prime authority is the Bible, which takes him back to the creation. And he works out notoriously that it was 4004 BC. And this is always kind of cited as a hilarious example of gullibility of Christians. But actually, it's a pioneering attempt to work out just how far back you can push the beginnings of time. And I think that from the point of view of discovering the existence of dinosaurs, you need to have a sense that the Earth is old and that it had a beginning. And actually, and it probably won't surprise you to hear me say this, Christianity is quite important in this, because what Christianity, like Judaism or Islam or before that Zoroastrianism, from which it gets the idea, it posits that there's a beginning and an end.
Yeah.
And so time, rather than being cyclical, it starts. That origin point just gets pushed back further and further and further. And I think it's telling that the people who do that are themselves kind of Christian priests, of whom the most interesting is a guy who we've already come across.
Yes.
I mentioned him in the French Revolution episode, because he's the guy who ate the heart of Louis the 14th.
So he's William Buckland.
Yeah. William Buckland.
So William Buckland was operating just down the road from where I am now, because I'm in Chipping Norton, and there's stuff about him in Churchill, the next village just down the road. So he's a clergyman, isn't he? He's professor of geology at Oxford University.
And he ends up dean of Westminster. I mean, he's an extraordinary figure.
And so he's basically the founding father of dinosaur of studies. Am I right? He coins the word Megalosaurus. He comes up with that word.
Yes, so great lizard. He does. And Megalosaurus is the first creature to get a kind of proper scientific Linnaean name. So, you know, the means defining living organisms coined by the Swedish naturalist Linnaeus, Carl Linnaeus.
Yeah.
But there's a brilliant complication to the story. So the Megalosaur bones are found in the Stainsfield quarries, where lots of the stone for the Cotswolds cottages that you love come from. Actually, a thigh bone of a Megalosaur was found there back in the 17th century. And it was given to a guy called Robert Plott, who was, I think, professor of chemistry. He was the founder of the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and he studies it and works out that it's, you know, what it is, and he has no idea what it could be. So he thinks, you know, is it a Roman war elephant? Does it come from a giant, one of the biblical giants? And he can't really work it out. Anyway, that vanishes, but somebody makes a drawing of it, and midway through the 18th century, another guy comes across this drawing, and he looks at it, and he thinks it looks like a scrotum.
Oh.
And so he gives it the Linnaean name Scrotum humanum. And under the universally accepted laws of scientific nomenclature, it's the first name that has to apply. So Megalosaurus is actually not It should probably be known as Scrotum Humanum. That's the first dinosaur.
That's
which is a brilliant story.
That's a terrible indignity for that dinosaur, isn't it? And for dinosaurs in general.
It really is. I think paleontologists agree that they're not going to run with that. So Buckland kind of identifies it as this giant ancient reptile. I think in 1822 he publicly presents it in 1824. Meanwhile, there's another guy, crucial guy, a doctor called Gideon Mantell.
This is the fellow in Sussex.
Yeah. And again, in 1822, he's paying a visit. His wife goes off to a quarry and she discovers this tooth, which Mantell, with the help of the great French anatomist, Georges Cuvier, identifies as belonging to an iguana, perhaps. It looks like an iguana, you know, kind of the lizards.
Hence iguanodon.
Yeah, so it's a tooth of an iguana. Over the course of the succeeding years, Mantell discovers kind of more and more bits of iguanodon. He discovers the bones of another giant ancient creature that he calls Hylosaurus. So there are these three land-based monsters, Megalosaurus, Hylosaurus, iguanodon. And nobody's quite sure what they are until in 1842, probably the greatest and the most unpleasant scientific figure in Victorian Britain.
The most unpleasant. Richard, that's harsh.
He's a horrible man. He's a guy called Richard Owen. He's a great man. I mean, he founds the Natural History Museum. He coins the word dinosauria.
Yeah.
So terrible lizards.
Yeah.
But he's an awful man, and he gets into a terrible feud with poor Mantell and basically drives him to an early grave. So Richard Owen refuses to allow Mantell kind of any credit for what he's doing. He mocks his conclusions. He brands him a fraud. He drives Mantell basically to bankruptcy. Mantell's wife leaves him. His son runs away to Australia. Mantell, he ultimate indignity, he has to move from, he gets so poor that he has to move from Sussex to Clapham Common.
Oh, that is
like... Clapham Common, he gets entangled in the reins of a runaway cab, gets dragged along the street. He gets scoliosis, and he ends up taking an opium overdose to control the pain and dying.
Well, and this is all the fault of the bloke who founded the Natural History Museum. That seems
The worst thing, and the worst thing is that, that Richard Hewitt takes his body and keeps his skeleton in a jar.
Okay, that's pretty weird.
His twisted, you know, he's got the scoliosis, so his spine is twisted.
Yeah.
So poor Gideon Mantell, being persecuted to death by Richard Owen, ends up in a jar. And then I think they threw it out in the 60s because it was surplus to requirements. So this poor man,
wow, that's given me a whole new way of thinking about my enemies and the punishments I will visit upon them one day.
Well, Owen kind of got his punishment because he got in a massive butt up with Darwin,
right,
and opposed Darwin, so he ended up kind of on the losing side. But, I mean, he was a huge thing. And actually, there was always a large statue of Richard Owen in the Natural History Museum, which then got moved and replaced with one of Darwin. So, in a sense, the ghost of Gideon Mantell
was laughing.
I mean, he would have enjoyed that. But the other thing that Richard Owen does is to... he teams up with a guy called Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins, who is a sculptor, in the wake of the Great Exhibition. And the Great Exhibition, you know, the Crystal Palace gets moved to South London. And as part of that, they think that they're going to have a kind of a prehistoric diorama. And so they start building models of these dinosaurs that Owen has just named. And famously, they get it wrong because Owen has got it wrong. And one of the things that Owen and Mantell had been arguing over was whether, for instance, Megalosaurus and Iguanodon, were they bipedal or were they quadrupeds? Mantell had argued correctly that Iguanodon was bipedal, so still on its hind feet. Owen said, no, they're kind of massive, squat, tank-like creatures. And so that's how they are built. So if you go to Crystal Palace today, you look at them, I mean, they're absolutely fabulous. If you haven't been to them, you're in South London, do go and see them. They're really wonderful. So they're the kind of the very first dinosaur theme park. But Owen has got them very, very badly wrong. And there's a famous As part of the publicity for this, famously, they have a kind of, I think it's New Year's Eve. They have a dinner, New Year's Eve in 1853, I think it is. They have a dinner inside the Iguanodon as a kind of publicity thing.
And Tom, why is this all happening in Britain? Or are similar things happening somewhere else? Is it that Britain is more... I don't know. Most, I mean, there are other countries, France, for example, are Germany, well, what becomes Germany later on, are very scientifically advanced. Why aren't they making similar strides?
It's really interesting. So people are discovering that. So, for instance, people are finding pterosaurs. So that's flying reptiles from the Mesozoic, say in German quarries, but they're not putting. And they're finding giant aquatic creatures in Belgium and Holland. But they're not kind of bundling it together. And I think it's something to do with, well, we were talking about the Industrial Revolution yesterday. It's the scale with which people in Britain are kind of looking at the land, because it's to do with, you know, the extraction of coal. It's to do with the blasting of rock, increasingly trying to lay railways, all that kind of stuff, that there's a need to understand the geology of Britain. And so therefore, when you're looking at the geology, inevitably you're starting to find right. all these fossils.
Yeah.
And there's just a kind of curiosity about it that enable and a kind of range of kind of mingled amateurs and men of science who kind of just put it together. So I think that one of the things that's really interesting about dinosaurs is the way that their discovery is kind of associated with the Industrial Revolution. So even though they are expressions of a kind of unimaginably distant past, and people find it incredibly destabilizing, of course, to realize that actually time is much, much deeper than they'd anticipated, they are also kind of cutting edge, which is why they appear at the Crystal Palace, which is this great monument to British know-how and get up and go. And it's why in Bleak House, in the opening paragraph, Dickens fixes on, you know, he describes the mists that are kind of filling London, and he says that it wouldn't be a surprise to see a Megalosaurus walking up Holborn Hill. He is, you know, that's a cutting edge reference.
Yeah,
absolutely cutting edge.
So it's sort of pushing the frontiers of science, isn't it? I suppose forwards and backwards, as it were. Now, I was about to say we've got a few questions about the Victorians, so maybe this is a good place to do them. Alyssa McCarthy has a question about gentleman collectors. How much are gentleman collectors driving the sort of the progress in paleontology? And Mark Kirk Alves has a question that I wanted to ask, which is about Mary Anning. So Mary Anning operated Lyon Regis, and basically, I think by internationally approved binding laws, all British children now have to learn about Mary Anning, and it's unthinkable that they don't. Now, Mark Kirk Alves says, did she really play a role, or were we just desperate to make the subject relatable to girls? So is it gentlemen collectors? Does Mary Anning matter? What's the story?
It is gentlemen collectors. Because William Buckland and Gilly Mantel and people like that, you know, they're all gentlemen, essentially. And you have to be a gentleman, you have to be of gentle breeding, and you have to be a man to get your papers accepted by the requisite societies, which is why Mary Anning is marginalised through her life. Absolutely. I mean, she is an astonishing figure. It's not
so just give us a sense of who she is, Tom, for those listeners.
So the reason that I haven't mentioned Mary Anning up to now is that this is about dinosaurs. And dinosaurs are land.
She's fossils, right?
She's absolutely fossils. Dinosaurs are land-based. Mary Anning is discovering creatures that swam in the seas. So at the time, most of Dorset was underwater.
Yeah.
So that's why Mary Anning is finding ichthyosaurs, which kind of look like, you know, dolphins. She's finding plesiosaurs, which is the Loch Ness monster type, with the long neck and the flippers. She is discovering pterosaurs. She's identifying coprolites, which are basically fossilized turds. And she's an amazing, amazing pioneer. And she comes from the most kind of grinding poverty. She, as a child, was she was under a tree with three women, and lightning struck, and all the women died of the lightning strike, and she survived. And the theory was, in Lyon Regis, that this had kind of given her her spark, her curiosity. I mean, she could, you know, she learned to read and write, but she had no real kind of scholarly background greater than that. And yet she achieves this kind of revolution in the understanding of the past, that the scale of her discoveries and her ability to understand what it is that she's finding is amazing. And they get, essentially, they kind of get the gentleman scholars are like jackals feeding on her kills, and she doesn't really get any of it. There's one hero in this, which is a guy called Henri de la Biche, who is an illustrator who illustrates what is effectively the very first illustration of a prehistoric landscape. And it's in Latin, it's called Dorset as it was long, long ago. And it, you know, it shows long-necked plesiosaurs kind of crunching on pterosaurs, and it shows ichthyosaurs. And there's, you know, Mary Anning has basically discovered that, you know, she's advanced his thesis that feces can be fossilized. And there's, I think it's a plesiosaur who's in the process of being munched to death. He's literally shitting himself. And you can see this, these kind of turds dropping down to the bottom of the sediment, you know, the bottom of the sea, where they in due course will be fossilized and then be discovered by Mary Anning. So she's a massive figure, but she's not discovering dinosaurs, because Lyme Regis is, you know, in the Mesozoic was sea, not land.
So I wanted to ask about Christianity, because we're in the mid-Victorian period, the age of Darwin, but I think we should take a break. So people have got that to look forward to, which is very exciting. We'll talk about that, then we'll get into America, and then we'll talk about 20th century dinosaurs and dinosaurs, kind of metaphorical meanings and so on, and we'll do all that after the break, so don't go away.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking dinosaurs and the history of the ways in which they've been understood. So, Tom Holland, we have reached the sort of mid-19th century. There have been tremendous breakthroughs in the understanding of dinosaurs, the coining of the word dinosaur, for example, the exhibition of kind of recreations of dinosaurs and so on. So the big question is, how does this affect what is a very, you know, God-fearing age? This is the age of Darwinism, obviously, but it's also an age of tremendous sort of interest in Christianity, tremendous debate and so on.
Do dinosaurs break people's faith, or do people fit them into the Christian story? What do they do?
I don't think dinosaurs per se particularly affect people. I mean, you know, Buckland, you know, as I said, he becomes the Dean of Westminster. It's how dinosaurs fit into Darwinism really starts to shake people's faith. Because, of course, the idea that dinosaurs are, you know, which is still there in the way that we use dinosaur as a kind of a pejorative to this day, this idea that there were these ancient monsters and then they kind of became superseded because they were kind of run out of town by evolutionary forces, which kind of beds in pretty quickly, because the uptick in the discovery of dinosaurs, particularly in America, coincides with the explosion of kind of Darwinism. And it's that really that unsettles people. So I'll give you an example of a man whose faith does get very radically affected by it, but it's the interplay between his discovery of dinosaurs and Darwinism. And this is a guy called Edwin Drinker Cope, who is a Quaker from Pennsylvania, right. Who's brought up with a kind of literal belief in Genesis and the flood and all that kind of stuff. But he's also obsessed by natural history. And as the Western frontier is being pushed ever further towards the Pacific, so he goes in its wake. So along with all the buffalo hunters and the prospectors and all those kind of people, Cope is riding out into the Wild West looking for dinosaurs. And he's out there in 1877 in the Bighorn Mountains when Custer gets wiped out. And it doesn't stop him from, you know, he's dodging the Sioux war bands and so on. And he ends up having these terrible nightmares in which dinosaurs kind of appear and jostle him and trample him down. And I think that that's kind of expressive of this anxiety he has about whether evolution, which he's coming to accept, can be squared with a belief in a kind of loving God. And it imposes ever greater strains on him. And he ends up, essentially, he leaves the Society of Friends. He gives up his Quaker faith. And he actually kind of becomes a racist, because the only way that he can justify believing in the benefits of God is if he argues basically that every human, every living organism has a kind of endpoint that has been defined by God. And so all species are kind of inexorably moving towards it. And if that's the case, then that must be true of human beings, and therefore, you know, people like him must be way up further up the evolutionary train than people who don't know about evolution.
So he becomes kind of scientific racist, basically.
He becomes a scientific racist despite himself. I mean, he doesn't want, you know, he kind of abandons his belief that all, you know, this Quaker conviction that all human beings have a kind of fundamental dignity. He ends up losing it, but Cope is also famous for what is one of his notorious rivalries in science, which he has with another American scientist, a man called Charles Othniel Marsh. And he's also going out. He's untroubled by Darwinism. And he discovers what is one of the classic proofs of it, the evolution of the horse. But Marsh also discovers an enormous number of dinosaurs. So between them, they're discovering loads of the classics, kind of, you know, all the long-necked ones, the sauropods, Triceratops, all these kind of ones. Because it turns out, and I think that that this is a kind of wonderful way in which dinosaurs provide a brilliant metaphor for 19th and 20th century history, but as industrial supremacy is leaching from Britain to the United States, so also does the lead in paleontology, because it turns out that in the West, these lands that are being opened up by the army, there are enormous numbers of dinosaurs, and you can dig them up.
Now, why is that? Is it something to do with the soil, or what's the story?
It's to do with the geology. It's to do with the fact that, you know, there aren't kind of picturesque villages everywhere, so you can just, you know, dig up whatever you find. All along the Rockies, right the way up to Canada, there are just enormous, enormous numbers of dinosaurs waiting to be found. Yeah. And Marsh and Cope, you know, there are so many that basically they, you know, I mean, it's a brilliant metaphor for American capitalism, because they compete with each other so brutally. You know, they would rather smash bones up than need them to be discovered by the other guy. Yes. And they end up kind of both of them kind of basically bankrupt. A monopolist moves in and buys up all their stuff, and that monopolist is Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah, you couldn't make that up, could you? I mean, it's just a perfect metaphor.
And Andrew Carnegie is interested, I mean, he's not interested in paleontology for his own sake. He's interested in massive dinosaurs that will make a huge statement. He wants a dinosaur that is as big as his own kind of industrial ambitions. And so he buys one called Diplodocus, that is the, at that point, the longest dinosaur that had ever been discovered. He buys it up. He names it after himself.
Why do you say Diplodocus and not Diplodocus?
I don't know. I just always know.
Okay. I was just brought up as a Diplodocus man, and I've tried to instill that in youngsters that I meet. But
I don't know what the correct pronunciation is.
Okay. This is a sort of Cope Marsh type feud.
So, and then what Carnegie does is he makes casts of it, and he sends it first of all to London. So that's the one that was in the Natural History Museum for a long time.
Yeah, which we all remember, you know, yeah.
But he does other casts and he sends it round. So it's a kind of wonderful illustration of the way, in, you know, Carnegie himself was from Scotland originally. So it's just that industry is passing from the old world to the new, and the new is now starting to export it back to the old. It's kind of perfect illustration of it. Is that at this point, the idea of dinosaurs as slow, lumbering, dumb, hopeless creatures that have gone extinct because they've been wiped out by mammals hasn't kicked in yet. So it's still fine for Carnegie to associate a dinosaur with his own industrial concerns, as it is with the Sinclair Oil Company, which takes as its logo a sauropod, a dinosaur.
And we're about to get to the point of with T-Rex, aren't we? The discovery of Tyrannosaurus Rex and this extraordinary man, Barnum Brown, who went around in long fur coats and was a great sort of showman. So what's the story with him? Is he a real paleontologist? Or the very word Barnum kind of makes me think he's just running a circus or something.
Well, he's from the Natural History Museum in New York.
Mr. Bones. Don't they call him Mr. Bones?
Well, he's a showman in the way that, you know, Buffalo Bill is. I mean, you know, this is still kind of the age where the mythology of the West is still incredibly current. And he makes play with it. You know, and he is the Eastern gentleman going out west, so that's why he's wearing a fur coat. And also, he's incredibly predatory, because he discovers actually that the best fossil deposits are up in Canada, and that in no way stops him from taking all the bones and sending them to New York. And you're starting to get the sense that you know, America's global ambitions are manifesting themselves through the appetite of American paleontologists for fossils. So you've got Barnum Brown kind of digging up T-Rexes, such like creatures, all the way up the west, deep into Canada. And then in the 20s, you have this guy, Roy Chapman Andrews, who is the guy who discovers the Protoceratops eggs. So he goes on a series of kind of amazing expeditions to the Flaming Cliffs in the Gobi Desert. And he, it is said, I don't know how accurately, is one of the models for Indiana Jones. He's a, you know, he's got a whip and...
he's frightened of snakes, fights Nazis.
All that kind of stuff. So it's a kind of, you know, it's something that men of action want to be associated with. But again, to pursue this idea that dinosaurs provide a metaphor for the process of capitalism and industrialization, in the Great Crash, so in the Depression, you increasingly start to get the sense that actually dinosaurs are a bit of a dead end, that they are properly for children, and that dinosaurs themselves are kind of evolutionary dead ends that don't really matter. They're ponderous and slow and lumbering. And I think that's an image of them. It's still kind of just about current to this day.
To pick up one of our previous podcasts, in GoldenEye, M calls James Bond a racist, misogynist dinosaur. Of course, dinosaurs were neither racist nor misogynist, were they? But, to go from Bond to something he knew a lot about, the Cold War... There comes to be this interesting kind of thing with communist and capitalist dinosaurs, doesn't there? So in the Soviet Union, dinosaurs are imagined differently from how they are in the West.
Yes. So if you think the classic image of a Mesozoic scene, which has been replayed in countless numbers of films, the classic image perhaps is a Tyrannosaur against a Triceratops. You always get it. You know, the Triceratops with the three horns, the Tyrannosaur with the giant teeth, and they fight each other. And in the kind of the classic American illustrations, you have a T-Rex, you have a Triceratops, and it's like a kind of shootout in some Wild West town outside the saloon. It's the sheriff against the bad guy.
Who's the sheriff? The Triceratops.
Yes, I guess the Triceratops is the sheriff. He's seeing off the the battle rustler. In the Soviet Union, there was a famous artist called Konstantin Konstantinovich Flyerov, and he during Operation Barbarossa, as the Nazis were laying siege to Leningrad. He was in Leningrad, I think, or maybe he was in Moscow, I can't remember. Anyway, he's in one of them. And he did a spectacular illustration of a T-Rex Triceratops face-off. But what he did was to have a whole number of Triceratopses, and they've kind of formed a phalanx so that their horns bristle like spears. Yeah. And there are three kind of predatory tyrannosaurs circling it, but they can't break in. So unlike in the American, where you have Triceratops as a kind of lone gun, in the Soviet version, they're a collective. Because the Soviet army gets to see off Hitler, so the Triceratops get to see off Tyrannosaurs. And I think it's kind of really, it does show how readily, you know, the prehistoric world lends itself to kind of all kinds of metaphors like that.
But the field of understanding dinosaurs, I mean, the history of it is, as you've shown, fascinating, but it didn't stop being fascinating, did it? Because am I right in thinking in the 60s and 70s, or maybe I'm a bit early, maybe 70s and 80s, there were huge kind of convulsions in the study of dinosaurs. So people had thought they were cold-blooded, and then they thought they were warm-blooded. They had thought they're reptiles, and then they basically think they're birds. You must know tons about this, because you're very into this dinosaurs and birds business, aren't you?
Well, you quoted Bob Backer at the beginning of this episode, and he wrote a famous book called The Dinosaur Heresies, in which absolutely, you say, he argued that dinosaurs were warm-blooded, that they were mobile, that they were incredibly successful. At the back of this was a discovery made in the 60s of a dinosaur called Deinonychus. Deinonychus had been discovered earlier, but it's a guy called John Ostrom argues that Deinonychus means terrible claw, and these were very mobile. They seemed to attack in packs. They could run, they could jump. So they were the opposite of ponderous. And he extrapolated from this an argument that dinosaurs were just kind of basically terrifying. And it's Deinonychus that is Velociraptor in Jurassic Park, because Velociraptor sounds more frightening. So and also, obviously, Deinonychus bears a very strong resemblance to birds. And this was something that wasn't original to Ostrom. Actually, Thomas Huxley, who was...
Darwin's bulldog.
Yes, a great titanic figure of late Victorian science. He had argued that the birds were basically dinosaurs, but that was an argument that got parked, but it gets revived in the 60s. And essentially now people would say... So that Backer passage, you know, he says dinosaurs are extinct. I think most people now, most scientists, and I speak completely as a non-scientist, would say that dinosaurs aren't extinct because birds are dinosaurs. So they're still around. Right.
So all the old stuff about the death of the dinosaurs is overheated.
And so that is the other thing that happened, was that the great mystery for you know, a century and more was what happened to the dinosaurs. Where did they go? Why did they become extinct? And so you had all, you know, the Gary Larson, the famous Gary Larson cartoon, terrible news, guys. We're complete, you know, we've got brains the size of a walnut and there are loads of mammals taking over. Yeah. That was basically why people thought that they were kind of hopeless and a dead end. But it was in the 80s, so in 81, a brother and father team of geologists at Alvarez, Père et Fils, identify this kind of strain in the sediment at the end of the Cretaceous period when the dinosaurs go extinct, of iridium, which seemed to imply that there'd been a kind of an asteroid hit. And they argued that this perhaps was what had killed the dinosaurs. And this was a theory that got kind of stress tested and ultimately, I mean, pretty quickly came to be almost universally accepted. And the impact point got discovered. It's in Mexico. And essentially, the dinosaurs went extinct due to bad luck.
But they didn't go extinct if they're still around.
Flying around. So the non-avian dinosaurs went extinct due to bad luck. So you have this combination of the realization that dinosaurs have been mobile, lots of them perhaps have been warm-blooded, that they were basically birds, combined with this sense that the fact they'd gone extinct wasn't really their fault, which was all of which fused just in time for Spielberg's film Jurassic Park.
So Michael Crichton's novel, which predates it, obviously.
A seismically important film because it portrayed dinosaurs in a way that was as true to how the kind of cutting edge understanding of paleontology as was possible.
So they move in herds, they are clever, they're ingenious,
but they're also flooded. I don't know if you remember there's a bit where the children that you always get in Spielberg film, they're hiding in the kitchen or something.
Yeah, very famous.
And the velociraptor blows on the glass and it steams up, so you know that you're feeling something very, yeah, very frightening. And then they work out how to open the door, and there's kind of another amazing scene where they break into the lab where they've been extracting the DNA, and the kind of computer code is luminous and green, and it kind of spills over the head of the velociraptor. And again, it's doing what had happened back with the Crystal Palace. It's casting dinosaurs as cutting edge. You know, these are creatures that you can link with computing and with DNA and with absolutely cutting edge theme parks. So Jurassic Park is kind of absolutely the heir to the Crystal Palace.
Although Jurassic Park, it's interesting you say that, because Jurassic Park kind of cuts against the much of what we've been talking about, which is the advance of science, fantastic potential of science and human curiosity to find out about what went before. I mean, Jurassic Park is all about the dangers of science, isn't it? Rather than so much specifically the dangers of dinosaurs, it's the kind of, you know, Frankenstein's kind of science run amok, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it is the Frankenstein story. And if you go to a theme park, I mean, you know that everything's going to go wrong. I mean, the same is true as you go to a cowboy theme park.
Yeah, Westworld.
You know,
yeah,
the gunslingers are going to come after you. I did not take away from watching Jurassic Park, ooh, we shouldn't try and bring dinosaurs back. I took away, it would be amazing.
You're the Richard Attenborough figure. I'm Jeff Goldblum.
So the kind of the stop-start technology that they used in, you know, Million Years BC, those kind of films, was appropriate to the kind of dinosaur people understood then, slow, ponderous, sluggish. The fact that you had CGI and that Jurassic Park was the first film to use CGI to bring dinosaurs to life. I mean, you remember the scene where they, Sam Neill and Laura Dern are going along the Jeep, and then they turn around and they kind of take their shades off and their hats and gaze in wonder.
Yeah,
and then you look and there's the Brachiosaur coming out.
Yeah.
And I felt that. Just seeing it in CGI, I never imagined I'd see a dinosaur that brilliantly brought to life. And it kind of turbocharged for lots and lots of people the study of dinosaurs. And ironically, one of the things that it did, so at the end of Jurassic Park, they're flying out in the helicopter. They've had a terrible dive. Sam Neill says to Richard Attenborough, he's not going to approve the park. And then they look out and they see a flock of birds going across the sea. And the implication is obviously that birds are dinosaurs. And at the point, that was still not a universally accepted thesis. But in the years that followed, I mean, actually almost immediately, a series of incredible finds began to be made in China. And these were finds that showed conclusively that lots of dinosaurs had been feathered. And that basically, you know, there was a whole line of dinosaurs that had become birds. The effect of that was that for the first time, you know, in over 100 years, the most interesting center of dinosaur discoveries and finds and research was no longer the United States, but China.
Oh, there's another metaphor.
Absolutely. There's a kind of another amazing metaphor that, I mean, it's kind of very odd that if you think of, you know, the lead passes from Britain to America and then to China. The same thing happens with dinosaur discoveries and the degree to which that is just a metaphor, whether there's something deeper.
Yeah. And where, what about, obviously we are living in an age where we're so much more conscious of geological time, of the earth, the changing climate, all those kinds of things. So where does that leave dinosaurs? I mean, obviously they no longer are these kind of, well, for children, they still are, aren't they? They're mythical monsters, Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know. But I think for adults and for people who are interested in dinosaurs, they now
have a very different role in our imagination than they did 50 or 100 years ago. Is that right?
Well, you still get dinosaurs being used as a pejorative. So that's still kind of current.
So when I make a reference to Jordan, the reality TV show star on our podcast, you mock me as a dinosaur. You probably, I think you call me granddad, but I felt the dinosaur was hanging in the air.
Yeah, I would never have used that. I hope I did, because I know better. I think it's an understanding of dinosaurs that has percolated through, because I think that a crucial part of anxiety about climate change and about mass extinction that is going on at the moment has been hugely, hugely sharpened by the sense that the Mesozoic ended in a kind of catastrophic ball of fire, that the seas boiled, that the flesh fell off the bones, that 94%, 95% of all living organisms were wiped out in the blink of an eye, because it has brought home, I suppose, the how vulnerable Earth is.
So it's almost a story about hubris to some extent, is it? It's a story about inevitable disaster looming. It's the apocalypse is coming. The end of the world is nigh. Don't you think that's shot? The dinosaur story shot through with that.
I do. So I think that. To go back to Christianity, if there's a beginning, then there's an end. And I think that the dinosaur, the kind of so many illustrations of the asteroid hitting and a kind of pterosaur looking or tyrannosaur glancing around and this plume of light, it gives us a kind of scientifically updated vision of apocalypse, of the end of the world. Except, of course, it's not the end of the world, because then life recovers. Life has a way.
Yes.
There's a Jurassic Park. I think the complication for us is that it forces us to ask, now, are we the asteroid?
Oh, are we the asteroid? Yes.
Are we the asteroid? Yes. Is Homo sapiens the asteroid? And it's the process of industrialization brought to life, facilitated the discovery of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
That is now perhaps leading to global catastrophe.
That's a lovely, cheerful note on which to end. Everything has a beginning, everything has an end. But we should end with one last question, very much in the spirit of the podcast. Martin Perry, who would win in a fight between a Tyrannosaurus and a Stegosaurus?
Well, neither would, because they didn't coexist.
That's like Mary Beard being evasive about Alexander the Great versus Julius Caesar.
Tyrannosaurs are closer to us than Stegosaurs were to Tyrannosaurs.
That's a fantastic fact, isn't it? That's like Cleopatra's closer to us than she was to the building of the Great Pyramid. One of those amazing...
I imagine a Tyrannosaur would win.
Would it? So was a Tyrannosaur... The general sense now, isn't it, the Tyrannosaur was actually completely useless. Is that right, or is that just... overstated?
Yeah, massively overstated. No, okay, they're not good.
I'm glad we're clear.
You would not want to be bitten by a Tyrannosaur.
Well, since we don't coexist, I'm pretty confident that's not going to happen. Right, on that bombshell, I think we shall... thank you, Tom, for that tour de force. I did so much talking in Watergate. It was nice to have a rest this time. And it is a fascinating subject. We have coming up... Remind me what we have coming up on Thursday. We have a history of India in 10 buildings. And then we will be back next week with... Golden Ages. When was the Golden Age? And is there such a thing? Right, we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.